Hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, February 27th, 2013, and I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with my guest host, Nicole Nelson, and she's here on the other mic.
Hello.
Hello. My guest for the entire hour is poet Stephen Dunn. He's been on before, and I'm delighted to have him back. He's the author of 16 poetry collections, including What Goes On, New and Selected Poems, 1995 to 2009. He was awarded the Pulitzer for his collection Different Hours. He has also been a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and has received an Academy Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. And he's here this morning to primarily talk about his newest collection, Here and Now, that's now in paperback. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to be back.
Great to have you. So much to talk about in this hour, but I wonder if we can start, as we tend to always start on this show, by talking about your newest collection, Here and Now, and how it came about. I mean, I don't know if you can talk about the poems, if from collection to collection you land on themes, or if you see what you have once you publish a book and you start writing new poems and you see what you have. I don't know. How does that go?
It's something like the latter, though it's happened in various ways. I write the poems as they come, and if you're lucky, they start to want to hang around together, which means that you've probably been following some obsession or two that you didn't quite know about until you did. I think that was the case with this book, that it seemed to be a book and divided itself into categories, into tones, some a little more political than others for me, and some men-women poems, which has long been a subject of mine. And then I tried to put the best of them together, hopefully leave the worst of them out.
Are there a lot that you leave out?
A good many, though I think my ratio of success these days is somewhat higher than it's been before. But yeah, certainly I leave some out. Often I regret that too.
Would you pull them into another collection, or once they're past, they're past?
Yeah, I think I have done that, certainly. Trying to think if any in here that have come forward. Probably the title poem, Here and Now, comes from a poem that started in 1964, believe it or not. And if I'd forgotten, I had even written a poem like that. And an old friend of mine, who I realized was not really a good friend, but I met him for lunch, and he had this poem. And it was one of those poems that was talented but not very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed with it for a while, and it turned out to be, I think I made it into a real poem. That's quite an unusual gap of time, though.
Do you want to read it, Here and Now?
Sure.
Okay.
It's dedicated to my wife, Barbara. All right. The pages won't come apart. Okay. I got it.
Okay.
Here and Now, for Barbara. There are words I've had to save myself from, like my Lord and Blessed Mother, words I said and never meant, though I admit a part of me misses the ornamental stateliness of high mass, that smell of incense. Heaven did exist, I discovered, but was reciprocal and momentary, like lust felt at exactly the same time. Two mortals, say, on a resilient bed, making a small case for themselves. You and I became the words I'd say before I lay me down to sleep, and again when I'd wake, a wishful words, no belief in them yet. It seemed you'd been put on earth to distract me from what was doctrinal and dry. Electricity may start things, but if they're to last, I've come to understand a steady, low-voltage hum of affection must be arrived at. How else to offset the occasional slides, neglect, and ill temper? I learned in time to let heaven go its smithy way, to never again be a supplicant of any single idea. For you and me, it's here and now, from here on in. Nothing can save us, nor do we wish to be saved. Let night come with its austere grandeur, ancient superstitions and fears. It can do us no harm. We'll put some music on, open the curtains, let things darken as they will.
Thank you. That's wonderful. It's the title poem, and I'm curious the positioning of it in the book. How do you arrange the poems? I mean, are you looking for a certain flow, again, back to theme or feeling, or how does that happen?
I tend to put the poem, a poem I most like that I think is most representative, as the last poem in the first section. I hate to say it because you might check my
previous. Now I'm going to look.
You'll find terrible poems. I do that, and it's often very arbitrary how poems get together, but sometimes it's a matter of diction, a matter of theme. In this case, I liked it following that the poem called Love, where I was challenging, it's two poems away from the poem called Love, where I was challenging words and their meanings. And, you know, that poem takes on the word awesome, which is the most overused word of our language right now.
Mm-hmm.
And very few people have ever experienced anything like awe. And it tries to restore that word to its original meaning. So I have been working in a way, I thought, of a word, restoring words, words of restoration, so that the here and now poem begins that way with words that I wanted to, that I used in the past that I no longer believed in, and tried to be simple and come to words like you and I. Good words like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll move toward authenticity, I think.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with poet Stephen Dunn, and we're talking about his current collection, his newest collection, Here and Now. One aspect of your poetry that I've appreciated from the first time I saw one of your poems, which was on a bus in San Francisco in the early 80s, there was some sort of poetry project going on with the transit system, and I'm standing there holding on, and there was one of your poems kind of on a placard up above, and back then and still I'm always interested in your first person narrator, who is fascinated with the world and with relationships. And I'm curious, with each poem, are you writing from the point of view of a particular persona? Is it you? Is it, you know, sort of a conglomeration of characteristics that interest you that you've put together as a persona? And is it a different one every time?
Great question. I wish I knew the answer to it. I'm very conscious of managing that I as best I can, that first person. I have really very little interest in discovering anything about self. I'd rather the poem discover something about itself. So I tend to write my first person poems, especially poems that might have an experiential base, when I'm real bored with myself, so that I'm not so perhaps the lines might pass some test of being interesting. There are some that are closer to me, and some that that is me as me. And I'm trying to find a poem from another book to give you an example of maybe a funny example.
Well, what about the poem in New and Selected Poems called "The Routine Things Around the House"?
Oh yes,
which I love.
That's I've written an essay on that. That's one that that's very close to me, and I didn't falsify it. But it was a poem that would not end itself. I had it around for 10 or 11 years, published it in one version. I knew it was a good story, but I wouldn't put it in a book for the longest time because I thought I didn't get it right. And with a poem like that, which is about my mother showing me her breast on my request, to make a little error was to vulgarize the experience. I didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, one day, I held out long enough, and I got what I thought was a legitimate ending. That is, I thought the legacy she had given me was to make me comfortable with women.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that, and that was true enough. But it wasn't really true enough. And when I discovered that her true legacy was that she had taught me about limits, boundaries, the poem wrote, the ending came right away.
Can you read that one? Do you have that at hand?
I'll find it.
And then I'm curious about the essay, where the essay is and what... I forget
where I published it. It's called Degrees of Fidelity. It might be in a Grey Wolf anthology.
Okay.
I'm sure. I can't remember exactly.
All right. I'm going to look for that. Because that poem just, when I read it a few years ago, it just, you know, I had to mark it so I could find it again. It just...
I haven't read it in a long time, and when I used to read it at readings, women would come up to me, always around 40 or so. They'd be 40 or so. They'd be wondering whether they could have done that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they want to know whether it really happened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here goes.
Okay.
The routine things around the house. When Mother died, I thought, now I'll have a death poem. That was unforgivable, yet I've since forgiven myself as sons are able to do who've been loved by their mothers. I stared into the coffin knowing how long she'd live, how many lifetimes there are in the sweet revisions of memory. It's hard to know exactly how we ease ourselves back from sadness, but I remember when I was 12, 1951, before the world unbuttoned its blouse. I had asked my mother, I was trembling, if I could see her breasts, and she took me into her room without embarrassment or coyness, and I stared at them, afraid to ask for more. Now, years later, someone tells me cancers who've never had mother love are doomed, and I, a cancer, feel blessed again. What luck to have had a mother who showed me her breasts when girls my age were developing their separate countries. What luck she didn't doom me with too much or too little. Had I asked to touch, perhaps to suck them, what would she have done? Mother, dead woman who I think permits me to love women easily, this poem is dedicated to where we stopped, to the incompleteness that was sufficient, and to how you buttoned up, began doing the routine things around the house.
I love that. That's excellent.
It still holds up for me.
It does. It still holds up. It will always hold up. Nicole wants to get involved. Yay!
Hello, Nicole.
Hi there, Stephen. I love this poem, too. And you mentioned that the ending was something that troubled you for a while. I found a great quote from you. It's about 10 years old now, but about endings. And you said that you liked the end of the poem that feels syntactically right, but which doesn't lock the door. And
right.
I thought that was such a nice way to characterize a good ending. And so I'm wondering whether, you know, endings are usually something that you struggle with. And
well, I pay a lot of attention to them. I there are different philosophies of endings, and if you think of somebody like Merwin or Jean Follain, poets like that, they resist the click at the end. They don't want poems to click. I want my poems to kind of click in but remain ajar in some way,
mm-hmm.
remain open. But there are all kinds of ways. It depends on your... I mean, I think Merwin won't end a poem the way I will end a poem because his philosophy of life is such that he wants a continuum. He wants to suggest a continuum. Continuum that no given text closes up anything. But I do like that click. I don't want it to be a final click.
Hmm. Yeah, that's good. That's a good one. You know, likewise, you talk about, and I think you mentioned earlier, you talk about class and politics in your work a lot, and you do it in such a, whimsical way, bittersweet way. You just, you're not hitting anybody over the head with your opinions or your views. And there are a few poems that do this for me in this book. One is Little Good Song on 71. Another is The Revolt. Another is the Melancholy of Extraterrestrials.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, one of the reasons I think political poems are so difficult to write, and yet we must write them, I think, if we are inclined, is that we're likely to know our own our ideas in advance and just execute them. We don't discover anything. So my barometer for myself when I write such poems is really, as it is with all other poems, that the poems must discover something that the author didn't know before. So in the ones you mentioned, I think all of them are discoveries. They begin with imaginative imperatives more than experiential ones. As I can't remember anything like this exactly happening to me,
mm-hmm.
but certainly they're an amalgam of experience, and I hope I think each of them makes its discovery. What would you like to hear?
How about The Melancholy of Extraterrestrials on 75?
Okay. I'll tell you a little story before that.
All right.
I have a friend, Larry Robb Lawrence, poet Lawrence Robb, and we've had arguments for years since he's very fond of putting aliens and creatures in his poems. And I always tell him, you can't write a serious poem with aliens in it. And then he always does. And so I try, this was my attempt at one. he once wrote a poem, I can't remember the title of it now, but he uses all my arguments against me and for his favor, in his favor. It's a very funny poem. This one, I'll just read it. The Melancholy of the Extraterrestrials. Most of us who have insinuated ourselves into their work days and country clubs come home at night and immediately take out our little radios and report to the mothership that our accents have been perfect, our manners seamless and undetectable. I, for one, have lived for such praise. We look at each other, honored to be serving our planet, and break out a bottle of something and toast to seats on school boards and to those future sinecures of leverage in local government. To what end? That was only hinted at. Blend in, the elders told us. Be effective. When history becomes the subject of any gathering, remember to have sympathy for the Indians, mild disapproval for the colonists, and do try to be neutral whenever the talk turns to outer space. It was good advice, but the cost of our achievements began to show on our faces. After a while, I'd bring home a weariness, And when I look in the mirror, I'd see a creature made of smoke and pretense, losing desire to please the mothership, which had begun, all of us felt this, to take us for granted. Why were we doing what we were doing? Last week, one of the humans invited me to meet his wife and children. I've begun to fear that soon I might be asked to break into that stash of electroatomic weaponry we were given and do something otherworldly to those people, to these people, who in spite of their relative lack of culture and intelligence have shown me such kindness. They are guilty, I see now, only of being born on the wrong planet at a time of our ascendancy.
I love that. Thank you. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. I've been with Stephen Dunn, or we've been with Stephen Dunn, because I have Nicole here, too. Yay, Nicole. We're going to take a very short break, and when we return, we will have more Stephen Dunn, so please stay with us. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Weekly Signals, the only weekly news commentary radio broadcast that features a dog named Mahler. Weekly Signals with Nathan Callahan and Mike Kaspar. News with a Bite. Friday mornings at 8 here on KUCI 88.9 FM. Radio that keeps on giving.
Views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. We've been here for the entire hour, well, for the first half hour with Stephen Dunn, and he will be with us for the rest of the hour, thankfully, because we have more things to talk about than we'll ever have time for. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with Nicole Nelson. Hello there.
Hello, Barbara. I just came across that stanza that I wanted to read to you before in answer to your question of
persona?
Of the first-person narrators and persona.
Excellent. Okay.
It's in my second new and selected, the What Goes On book, poems 1995 to 2009. And it's the end of the poem called Cruelties.
Okay.
All day long, my former love, I've been revising a poem about us. First, a gentleman spoke it, then I gave the devil a chance. But you always knew my someone else could only be me.
Hmm. Interesting. So, yeah, so back to persona. So it changes from poem to poem. Sometimes it's you, like with the one you read about your mom. And often it's not you, but sort of you.
Or amalgams of me and others, and I think you know, you take a poet like Wallace Stevens, who rarely used the first person. All those poems seem to me very personal in the sense that they reveal sensibility, and maybe that's the most personal thing we have. Something, I mean, in a certain sense, experience belongs to everybody. Sensibility seems peculiarly one's own and style. So, I think I like to blend tones. There's a mixture of me, the real me, whatever that is, and the a collection of me's in a lot of poems.
And I had another craft question for you, Stephen, which is about words. And how much thought do you give to words as objects in terms of both structuring your poems and just the rhythm and the music of them?
I give a great deal of attention to that, of course. I mean, those are my tools.
Right.
And I try to use them well, and I try to make them pass hard tests too. Since my poems tend to be, relatively anyway, rather available to people, I always think that simplicity of some kind is an achievement rather than just saying what I know or what somebody else might know. That it has to be, it's hard won. So I pay a lot of attention to that and to the sonics of words, too.
So when you're revising, because I'm guessing that your poems go through a bit of that.
A lot.
So are you, when you're revising, is there a lot of, like, word choice changing going on that, no, this isn't exactly it, this is it. No, that isn't it. This, you know, I need a better one. I mean, how does
sure.
that go for you?
Well, I'm after some kind of precision of feeling, and you know, it seems to me that if we're going to get the ambiguous nature of life, of living, you need maximum precision to get at ambiguities and contradictions and all the things I'm interested in, paradoxes. So I pay a lot of attention to that, and I'm often wrong for a long time. Fortunately, I have a couple of good readers who set me straight occasionally, even though I tell them they're wrong initially. I tend to come around after a while. But, you know, it's if it were easy, everybody would do it, you know. I love Thomas Mann's little line about writers. For writers, writing is more difficult than it is for
So true. So very true. Well, you know, though, it's interesting that you became a poet in that you said that you grew up in a house without books and it
yep.
should have never been a writer. So then how did the poetry happen? I mean, did you find your way to an MFA program?
Eventually, but I was 30 when I did that. Yeah, I have several stories about that. Each of them is probably half true. I don't know really how I became a poet. And I had a little facility with language. out of the reading that I did do, and I took a chance, and I really wanted to, I worked in New York for a while in a corporate situation and hated it and was very good at it. I kept on getting promoted.
Was that the Nabisco?
Yeah,
writing for Nabisco.
So it was an attempt. I went to Spain on our savings, $2,200, and lived for 11 months in Spain to see if I could be a writer. Somehow that worked. It was an attempt to save my life, really.
Hmm.
That sounds melodramatic, but it was.
I like that. You know, I was thinking this morning because, you know, it seems that poetry scares people, and it scares writers. I have a group of students, especially beginning students. When I have these groups, I often say, okay, we're going to spend some time on poetry, and there's a lot of groaning and a lot of grimacing, and I wonder if it's because where fiction and nonfiction tend to be more entertainment than cause for introspection, poetry tends to push the reader inward, and except for maybe kids' poetry, which, you know, tends to be happy or funny, there's hardly any happy or funny adult poetry. And you know, I read poetry for the language and the poet's sensibility, but also it turns me inward.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Well, you know, it has a lot to do with the way it's taught. And yet you get lucky when you run into a good teacher and who teaches you that poetry is not written in code, and the teacher knows the code, and if you break the code, you get an A or something like that. I think what's crucial is people finding poems that matter to them. And probably you have to do that on your own a good bit, or run into good teachers who put you onto things that should matter to you. But I do think I think one way to do it is through funny poems, or funny poems that are humorous situationally. I'll read you one, okay?
All right.
I'll try anyway. It's a poem in Here and Now about the clown. If a clown. Now, I think this has other elements than humor, but it's a poem that I think when I have read it to people, everybody is interested in it, and I suspect it's for a mixture of tones, and some of those tones are humorous.
Okay.
If a clown came out of the woods, a standard-looking clown with oversized polka-dot clothes, floppy shoes, a red bulbous nose, and you saw him on the edge of your property, there'd be nothing funny about that, would there? A bear might be preferable, especially if black and berry-driven. And this clown began waving his hands with those big white gloves that clowns wear, and you realized he wanted your attention, had something apparently urgent to tell you. Would you pivot and run from him, or stay put, as my friend did, who seemed to understand? He was a clown who didn't know where he was, a clown without a context. What could be sadder, my friend thought, than a clown in need of a context? If then the clown said to you that he was on his way to a kid's birthday party, his car had broken down and he needed a ride, would you give him one? Or would the connection between the comic and the appalling, as it pertained to clowns, be suddenly so clear that you'd be paralyzed by it? And if you were the clown and my friend hesitated as he did, would you make a sad face and with an enormous finger wipe away an imaginary tear? How far would you trust your art? I can tell you it worked. Most of the guests had gone when my friend and the clown drove up, and the family was angry. But the clown twisted a balloon into the shape of a bird and gave it to the kid, who smiled, letting it rise to the ceiling. If you were the kid, the birthday boy, What from then on would be your relationship with disappointment, with joy? Whom would you blame or extol?
Thank you. Now, talk a little bit about this, where this came from, how this poem evolved.
I know exactly how it came from. I was driving to New Hampshire to the McDowell Colony to work for a month. And I had the radio on. I was listening to sports radio. And one of the people on the program said, an amazing thing happened today. A clown came out of the woods behind my house. And that was all. That's the start of the poem. And I went, it was the first poem I wrote at McDowell. And I just started there and made it all up.
So they come from all different places. They come from images, they come from lines.
Yep. I have a good notebook, too, that I keep of other people's good lines that I steal.
How about the revolt? It's on page 70 in my in my book.
Yeah, I wrote that at the time when I was feeling rather angry about losing a lot of money, and everybody was, you know, and it was, that's why I dated it October 2008, around the Madoff time. And
was that written around the same time as the one on the next page, Little Good Song?
No, that was written, Little Good Song was written the year before, actually.
They do sort of go together.
They belong together.
Yeah,
though.
They do. They do belong together.
That's why they're together. I'll read you the revolt.
Okay.
Picture a certain banker's house and its crawl space, and imagine a circumstance in which he has to crawl. If you want to take part, imagine rat's nests and a leaking pipe, and all the plumbers in the world tired of phones. For I have come to my banker's house, already having unscrewed what down below was screwed tight. I've rung his bell, and I've been made to wait in the garden and take off my shoes. Time used to be money. Now it's an invisible hand slapping you in the face. He has told me in so many words, my kind of industriousness is canceled by his kind of dream. He wrote a letter explaining this, the fallout from the windfall, the gobble and the gobbledygook, and four or five reasons why all necessity is his. If you want to take part, picture plush carpets in his favorite room and sets of antlers mounted next to portraits of his father and himself. Know you are only a few decimal points from being me. The waste in his pipe, his very own waste, well, you might say I've liberated it, let it out. My plan is to be sitting in his chair when he returns from where he'll have found himself knee-deep. If you want to be part of this, perhaps bring a friend. I'll meet you in the garden where I wait without shoes. Who knows what we'll do when his room is ours.
Thank you. How about a little good song, too, on the next page?
Little good song. It's good to sneak up from behind to the front. Good to sit for a while in the best seats. When the rich show up, it's good to explain how they're mistaken and cite the small, unreadable print. The meek are ready, you tell them, it says. The meek have come to take their seats.
Thank you. So that was a year before. Where did this one come from?
I have no idea. Really, it probably was a longer poem, and those were the best lines in it. I'm not sure. I don't remember.
You know, in a review I read of your poems about 4 o'clock this morning, the reviewer, I think it was in Zizova, the reviewer said that your poems are coded winks at the reader, words muttered under breath. Are they coded winks?
Maybe so. I don't know. I'm I'm actually learning a lot about my poems for the first time because in September, Syracuse University Press will be bringing out a book edited by Laura McCullough, which are 28 essays on my work by critics. And it's been alarming and interesting and fun, a little scary reading those. I've only read about half of them now, but they explain what I do. And I never knew what I did, so I think it could be constricting. I have no idea, but I have some idea of how I make poems now.
Do you read your reviews?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Can't help it.
Yeah. Yeah, how could you not? I mean, I think probably most writers do.
Yeah, some people claim they don't. They have more restraint than I do.
You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We have a few minutes left with Stephen Dunn. Do you get the first draft down generally in one sitting?
I do, actually, except when I'm working longer. Especially when I work at the writers' colonies, and I'm often there with Lawrence Robb, who's a friend, and we have a deal. We have, and it's irrevocable. You must have a draft by noon. No excuses. And we show it to each other. It's usually terrible. Or on its way to being something. And we criticize it, and then we go back to our rooms and work on it. I tend to work on the poems all year long.
I'm curious. I mean, at this point, you've had so much success that you must trust your process more than, say, new writers. But in the beginning, when you would write first drafts and think they were horrible, what was it that kind of pulled you past that point to where you were willing to get through the horrible to the not-so-horrible to the better to maybe a wonderful poem?
Well, every once in a while, to either be your own advocate or somebody else be the advocate of the poem, where you feel you've taken on something, you've found some language. You've startled yourself. That's usually my barometer. If I've startled myself and can pull off things after that, that's usually the revision process for me, because it's not enough to write a startling poem. My allegiance is to the whole poem, finally, and not to its moments. I need moments. I need the moments to be seminal and push me forward. And by moments, I mean things I didn't know I was going to say.
It might be fitting to talk a little bit about, or at least to read, Blind Date with the Muse, because, you know, writers, we're always waiting for that inspiration, and the Muse is kind of busy.
Okay. What page is
it? It's on 60.
Yeah. Not sure what I should say about it to begin with. I'll read it and then figure out what I might say. Blind Date with the Muse. Well, not exactly blind. I knew of her. I was the needy unknown, worried about appearance and what, if anything, she'd see beneath it. And desperate as this sounds, it was I who fixed myself up. I didn't mind being little man to the man I longed to be. Yes, she agreed. Then, I hope you're not the jealous type. I lied, and she named the time and place, told me there'd be others ever and always. The door was open, and there we all were, men and women, empty-handed and dressed down, each of us hoping to please by voice, by tone. In her big chair she welcomed or frowned, and one man she gently touched as if to say, don't despair, it will be delivered soon. Even as I hated him, I took heart. She was the plainest woman I'd ever seen. I wanted to make her up, but all arrangements seemed hers. I found myself unable to move. "You look lonely," she said, "a little lost, the kind of man who writes deathly poems about himself." "Sensitive, too," she added, and laughed. Thus began the evening the muse, that lifelong tease, first spoke to me. "If you want to be any good, you must visit me every day," she said. And then, "I'm hardly ever home."
That's wonderful. Thank you. You've been listening to Writers on Writing, and I've been with Stephen Dunn this entire time, which has been just perfect. I wonder...
That poem seems to me, you know, I think of it as a humorous poem and about the process, and it's in a section where there's a bunch of Ars Poeticas of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the serious aspect of the poem is that if you wish to be good, you gotta go there every day.
Yeah.
You gotta go to the place where things might happen.
Yeah, and getting away can help, can't it? I mean, it sounds like this is something you've done your entire life, or since you started taking writing seriously.
Well, I can get away right in my room.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't have to go too far, but I need a room. I need some place to work. To work at the writer's colonies is ideal for me, even though I have a good situation at home. To have all that time, and you know, unless you make deals, you're not supposed to talk to anybody till about 4 in the afternoon. That's a good time for
me.
And you've shared a lot of what you've found organically about what works for you in terms of process, like finding some obsession you didn't know about. I'm curious about teaching poetry, and you said you did have an MFA. Do you think it is possible to teach people to become poets, or...?
You could teach people to write better. Teach people to become poets, I'm not sure. I think... after teaching for over 35 years, that if I counted my success, or based my success as a teacher, on how many students turned to be poets, I should quit. You know, was it 1%, 2%, something like that? Mostly what we're doing, I think, is teaching people how to read better, and be aware of value and what's good, what's at stake. When I do that, I feel relatively successful. Some of my students have turned out to be poets, of course. That's very nice, but you can't count on it at all.
So when you say teach people to read better, are you talking about to be critical in their reading, to see how work is put together, how stories or poems are put together? I mean, what exactly
Sure.
do you mean?
That's part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, this, one of the ways I read now, which I think I used to read at least partially to be informed in a general sense. Now I read almost always to see how somebody got from one place to another
mm-hmm.
in a poem. I think the more we pay attention to our poems... I think it was Randall Jarrell who said that the poet who only is kind of a weekend poet or an occasional poet, the poem will never yield its secrets to him. You have to stay with it, be a good reader and a regular writer, and maybe the poem will reveal its secrets. And the act of writing a poem will reveal its secrets. And then, you know, I think he went on to say, if you write 15 good poems, you may be a great poet.
Wow.
So, it's something has to be at stake. And not in every poem, but finally you have to have taken on aspects of the world and yourself, and and the human condition that matter, or else you're going to be one of those poets that, and I like them too, I like people who pay attention to poetry, whether they're really good or not, generally, but you're not going to find stuff out. That the poem should show you.
Well, it has just been wonderful having you again, and sadly we're at the end of our time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're good.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Bye.
And for your work. Bye-bye. That was Stephen Dunn, and thank you, Nicole, for being here, too.
Thanks, Barbara.
Nicole will be here more and more, hopefully. Stephen Dunn, his book is here and now. He has quite a few collections. I think I have most of them, actually. And he's been a favorite, as I said, since... it's been a while, since the early 80s, probably. Since I discovered him while standing on a bus in San Francisco when they had that wonderful poetry project that all public transportation should have, you know? Anyway, we're at the end of our time. You've been listening to Pen on Fire. Writers on Writing. Not Pen on Fire. That's my book. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. I've been thinking about the Pen on Fire speaker series. We have a bunch of authors coming to Corona Del Mar, and there's info at penonfire.com. /speaker series, so look it up there. In the next few months, we have a bunch of events happening. That's it. Thank you. I hope to see you back here again next week.